Good morning, Maywood. I'm Coach Jake, and today, first half of the sermon, we're going to be in John 10. Jesus is going to be tearing down a lie that I think a lot of us buy into, and we're going to get through a story there. I'm going to talk you through a story my kids and I had about tater tots. I'm going to talk you through a conversation I had with a guy who had dealt a lot of meth and had a very disturbing insight about kind of love and the love that a mom has for her kids. And so we're going to get to some strange stories, but it's going to be in defense of us tearing down this lie that we buy into. But after we clear all that out, second half, I'm going to be leaning in on you guys. After I share some stories, I'm leaning on you guys to tell us, how have you seen Jesus be good? Especially, how lately have you seen Jesus be good? Because the passage that we're going to read today in John 10 is going to focus on Jesus. Like, there's stuff that we need to change, but the focus is on how good Jesus is. So I need your help when we get there. But John chapter 10, if you got a Bible, please turn there. It's really big that we get used to reading the Bible. The Bible is this amazing conduit for God to come and talk to us. And so I love that Dakota's right there. He's opening up a Bible, right? He's figuring out, where is it at? So that's what I want all of us to be doing. Open up a Bible. Open to John chapter 10. If you don't know where John's at, look at your table of contents. Chris is opening up a Bible for Heather. Like, get next to somebody who's got one open and try to read it. Even, you know, Mike and Sarah, you guys can do it too. Like, what do we do? So John chapter 10. Before we get to the stories about tater tots and the meth dealer and stuff, quick story to kind of set those ones up. I was in high school. I can remember a conversation with this guy. We were talking about what happens after you die. And this guy shared a view that I think a lot of people would be like, oh, yeah, that'd be nice. This guy was convinced that when people die, every single person goes to their own version of some sort of heaven. And it all works out for everybody, right? And my, like, 16 or 17-year-old self, you know, I knew about Jesus, and I tried to just, like, tear apart the, like, logic of that, which if you've ever been talking to somebody and you try to tear apart, like, the logic of something with them, like, not always fruitful, not fruitful in this conversation with that guy. Because I tried to talk about, like, who's setting up this heaven for everybody, right? For all these different people, like, who's the one behind all that? And he didn't have an answer to it, but it didn't seem to convince him, right? A lot of times, people walking around in the world, living the life the way they want to live it, if you show them a logical reason why the stuff that they're doing doesn't make sense, it's not that powerful, right? And it's because a lot of times we prefer some sort of lie to what's true. And you got to dig into, like, making us not want that lie so much to really get to it, right? So the lie that I think that guy was living into was this idea that what would be best for everybody is if everybody got their own way without hurting anybody else, right? This lie that, like, the ultimate good is me. The ultimate good for me is me. And as crude or, like, messed up or selfish as that sounds, a lot of us live our lives, whether we say it or not, as if me, I'm going to follow self. I'm going to follow myself and take care of myself. And we live that out, and we don't have space for what Jesus wants for us. So John 10, verse 10 is where we're going to start. And right here, it's going to blow up that thought I just said. So it says, the thief, some people view the thief as Satan. Some people view it as just leaders that are taking us away from where Jesus wants us to go. Some people view it as sin or disobedience, but here's what the thief does. Here's what evil does. It says, comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. You probably have some experience in your past where you did something you already know is wrong, and you can see how over time, what did it do? It stole something from you or your family or your friends. It killed something good or someone. It destroyed something that was precious, right? I mean, that's what evil does, right? We've all learned that the hard way. Here's what Jesus says. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. People love, Christians love this for, like, a bumper sticker, right? Jesus wants us to live the good life, right? But let me just take us to one truth that comes out of this. That idea, that lie, that I'm okay on my own, that my way is best, it doesn't sit well with this statement. Because what Jesus is saying is that there's this evil out there that wants to steal, kill, and destroy, but the answer isn't just be true to yourself or just ignore the haters or something like that. Like, that's not the answer. The answer is, Jesus says, I have come so that they can have life and have it to the full. It means that without Jesus, we're not getting to the good life. If you've been trying to get it all for yourself, then you don't jive with what Jesus is saying right here. Because what's an affront to our pride that we don't like to look at is that this implies that we need help. It's very hard for us to say those words, right? Something that, separates most kids from adults. Kids typically are just fine saying that they need help. Most adults have gotten to the spot where they don't want to ask for help. And you can start to see right away why God says that we should become like children to enter his kingdom, right? So two quick stories, because I think this lie of self, it's like a snake's tongue, right? It's got two kind of points at the end of it, right? So here's the two kind of forked pieces of this lie about self. One is this lie that self-indulgence is what happiness comes from. If I just give my body or my brain or my ego what I want, then I'll be happy. And I had a conversation with my kids the other day at dinner. They like to imagine this dream house that they get to have everything they want in. So Samuel and Sequoia will talk, or, oh, we should put this in our house. And that night we were having tater tots, and there was only so many tater tots. They'd already all been dished out. And so they both wanted more before they were even done, much like us, right? We want to get more before we even finish what we got. Chrissy and I's, when it comes to tater tots and stuff, it's always like, we'll finish what's on your plate. And then typically it's like, you can have a little bit more. You know, we'll put a little junk food out there to get them to eat the vegetables or whatever. So Christy and I both said, like, you can have a couple. You know, like, I took them off my plate because I know myself. Like, if I leave these on my plate, I'll accidentally eat them. But here, they're off my plate. You guys can have a couple more. And then Christy did the same thing. But then they got to talking, right, about their dream house. And Samuel said, in our dream house, Sequoia, we should have a tater tot the size of this whole neighborhood, is what he said. And she loved it, right? She was like, yes, the size of the whole neighborhood. So I've never even imagined a tater tot that big, but I started to, because that's how my brain works. You know, like, Chrissy's focused on important things, but I start thinking about, like, how horrible it would be to have a tater tot the size of our neighborhood, like, how that would instantly ruin our lives. how long would it stay hot? Probably a little while, but then, like, it gets soggy and terrible pretty fast. I think about, like, how many people would die when this thing falls out of the sky, which maybe not, but it would crush something. But then I think about, like, all the horrific flies or whatever that would show up, right? Because the size of a neighborhood, I mean, this isn't even just, like, the size of this room, right? I'm talking about, like, a city block or something of tater tot. It's like horrific. It would ruin, it would destroy everything around it, right? It would just become like worse than a dump, right? Like worse than a landfill. It would just be like the scourge of independence. Like Rolling Stones would no longer talk about us about meth, right? It would be like, that's the place with that horrible potato thing, right? But for the kids, they thought, if we just get a ridiculous amount of this thing that tastes good, then we'll be happy. That's as far as their brains went, right? Now, most of us don't dream about giant tater tots, but most of us want something that we have a little bit of, and we think, like, I'd be so happy if I just had a mountain of this. Some of us have gotten a mountain of whatever stuff we were after, right? I mean, that's where some of us got to rock bottom pretty quick. It's because we got a whole bunch of what we were after, and it really messed us up, right? It definitely wasn't like, oh, I got super happy once I got a big pile of whatever. So isn't that interesting, right? This lie that's there in self-indulgence. If I just had more, I'd be happy. And if you really think about it, if you had all that, you'd probably ruin yourself and everybody around you. It's easy to laugh about the tater tots, but think about whether it's respect from other people or whether it's some sort of money or some sort of possession, or whether you just told yourself, if I just had more time, blah, 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 right? But the reality is we're all given a day every day. It doesn't seem like that's been solving, right, your happiness thing. Self-indulgence doesn't lead us to happiness. Jesus said, I've come that they may have life, have it to the full. If you've been walking with Jesus for a little while, he's told you at some point, like, hey, you need to change this or that. You need to not do the thing you want to do. Jesus himself describes it as, if anybody wants to follow me, they must take up their cross and follow me, right? So I said it was a forked tongue, this lie of self. One is getting our own way doesn't actually make us happy. Before we get to that next one on this idea of getting in our own way, a little bit more practical example than giant tater tots. Actually, let's read this quote first. It comes from John Mark Comer, the guy that wrote this book. He says, we sin because we believe a lie about what will make us happy. And John has been a pastor for a long time, but he gets real honest in his book about the struggle that he's had with this lie and temptation for divorce. And here's the lie that he says he hears, and the other people, he says, hey, you deserve to be happy. Ooh. Let's face it. You haven't been happy in your marriage in years. Your wife just isn't the right fit for you. It happens. You married way too young, before you were self-aware, and this marriage just isn't what you hoped it would be. But if you were to divorce her, I'm sure there's someone else who would be a better fit and would make you happy. So that was the lie that he feels like he's faced. He says this is just a flagrant con. A cursory Google search of the research on long-term relationships will expose the dark comedy of it. But to be vulnerable, this one touches on some deep fracture in my own soul where I'm torn. A part of me, I'm going to talk about the negative part first. I'm going to kind of go back and forth. He says, a part of me, my flesh, just wants to live a feel-good, easy life, chasing the fantasy of sex and romance over the horizon. Like, that's it's a temptation, right? This idea of, like, it would all be better if it just wasn't for this other person, right? I'm just going to ignore that I made a commitment or a promise because I think I'd be happier. And when you read it, certain sentences don't really fit, right? About, like, someone to make us happy. It's like, it doesn't sound good. Deserve to be happy? Like, I don't know that we can claim that. But I want to read this other line. He says, another part of me wants to honor my incredible wife and stay faithful to my wedding vows. This is the one line I highlighted. This is the golden one. To let the power of the marriage covenant shape me into a man who's increasingly free of my need to get what I want. I'm going to read it again. To let the power of the marriage covenant shape me into a man who's increasingly free of my need to get what I want. You start to realize pretty quickly, like, self-indulgence leads to slavery, typically, right? We just, like, give in to what's easy over and over and over and over. We become a person who's not capable of very much. We also probably have all learned along the way. I was just talking to somebody talking about their dad. When they were a kid, they would ride their bike, and their dad could run farther than they could ride their bike. And he's like, that's the first time I saw what the power of exercise, right, of really getting into shape. Well, that's just a physical example of that truth. That to really get strong, you do have to say no to your selfish desires. And if Christ is going to make you into who you're meant to be, perhaps the hard thing you're going through, if you put it in his hands, perhaps that can be a tool to transform you rather than, like, fixing everybody else. But here's the other. I said that tongue has a fork in it, right? That tongue, a self, has two different ways that it lies to us. One is to be happy, get what you want. Don't think about it, right? The other lie is this idea that you can do it on your own. Self-reliance, right? So even as I read that stuff about marriage, some of you might have taken away from that, like, oh yeah, I just need to fix everything, right? I just need to be better. And here's what I told you, this meth story was coming up. So this is a good one, right? So whether you're watching a Disney movie or listening to a politician or listening to a sermon, everybody in our culture respects the love between a mom and her kid. It's super powerful. Everybody talks it up, right? Except for this guy that I was talking to that was had dealt a lot of meth. And here's the thing that he told me about a mom's love. He's like, everybody says that like the strongest force in nature is like a mother's love and blah, 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 blah. He's like, I've seen so many moms choose meth over their kids. And it was super disheartening because it was like very much a true, like this guy really had seen it. I knew he had dealt a lot of drugs, and he had really seen that over and over and over. And he said, basically, the addiction to meth is stronger than whatever that biological connection is between mom and kids. Now, meth addiction, you know, I'm not going to get up as an expert on it, right? I got to quote other people. But all of us, at some point, have had something that we knew was the right thing, that we knew we should do, that we even felt internally some pull to do the right thing. And we betrayed all those good things, and we did the selfish thing or the evil thing, right? I know that about myself, and whether you've ever been addicted to meth or not, or whether you're mom or not, the reality is we've all seen ourselves fall short of what we knew was the right thing to do. If you are going to make a super important bet, the reality is you're not a sure bet, and I'm not a sure bet, right? Like, if you're going to count everything on, like, oh, I'm going to count on Jake always doing the right thing, like, well, then you're going to lose that bet, right? Like, and it's not because I'm different than you guys. It's because we're all in the same boat, right? You can't rely on yourself to get to where you need to be. You can't rely on yourself to get to where you need to be. Jesus says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. You are not going to get the right marriage, the right parenthood, the right relationship with whoever, the right work ethic, whatever it is. You're not going to get the right sobriety. Just doing it on your own, right? Matt, I know Matt's got a year of sobriety today. Matt, where are you? Matt's right there, yeah? And so, Matt, did you get this last year by just doing it all on your own? No, right? I mean, it's an easy question to ask, right? Because you're just like, well, no, of course not. Like, nobody in this room ever got to, like, be a different person by doing it on their own. And we can lean on each other. That's a lot of the power of AA, right? And it's really good to lean on each other. It's much better than going on our own. But here, we have Jesus as someone actually stronger than us. Somebody who actually has the love to get us there, right? So we're going to read these. We're going to skip this quote from C.S. Lewis. Well, we'll glance at it real quick. It's a really good quote, and then we'll transition here. So C.S. Lewis, this gets back to Method A. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. So it's easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, I could quit smoking whenever I want if you've never actually tried. It's easy, I mean, as judgmental as we can get about smokers, it's easy to say, like, oh, yeah, I don't really gossip too much, or I don't really get very prideful. If you actually tried to go even a day where you really watched yourself on whatever sin you struggle with, you would see, like, oh, man, I tried to go the whole day without saying something that was wrong. If you just try to do that for a day, you'd probably realize, like, wow, I cannot control my own tongue, right? Hey, stuff came out that I didn't want to, or stuff came out that I'm ashamed of, or stuff came out that I wouldn't want to get a microphone up at Maywood and say in front of everybody, right, or something. You only know how strong stuff is when you resist it. You realize the grip it has on you. And Jesus is the only one, the only person who actually knows what it's like to say no to those temptations the whole way, right? He knows how deep down that temptation, you know, how strong it can be, because he's actually said no all the way down. He's actually come out the other side. So here's the deal with Jesus. We're going to read about him in this next part, because a lot of times sermons, it's easy to end a sermon with like a, okay, we're all pumped up, let's go do something about it, right? But as Christians, the point is never to start with, like, let's do something. Christianity is all about, like, what has Jesus done for us, right? So let's focus on what Jesus has done, and then we'll go a little further. So one more quote before we get to this passage. It says, this is Watchman Nee, this is like superhero guy from China. He wrote this book, Sit, Walk, Stand. It's incredible. He says, for Christianity begins not with a big do, but with a big done. This idea that as Christians, we never start with like, what can Jake accomplish? What can Matt accomplish? We never start with what can Ginny accomplish, right? It's what is Jesus already doing? What has Jesus already accomplished? That's where we start. We respond after we've paid attention to what Jesus has done, after we've accepted what Jesus has done, right? That's the wind that carries us. So here's what Jesus has done. We're going to read in verse 11. I am the good shepherd. This is Jesus talking. So he's talking about life to the full. He says, I am the good shepherd. We're going to go real slow through here. How do we define Jesus? How do we describe Jesus? The first descriptor there is good. A lot of times we don't even know what good is, right? Sometimes the things we do to try to be kind to somebody can be pretty messed up or twisted, right? Like, we don't always know what's good. But if you will look at Jesus, Jesus is good, right? So, good shepherd. Whatever comes into our life, whatever distractions are in our life, right? We come back to Jesus over and over and we say, Jesus is good. If I pay attention to Jesus, I'm going to see what's good. And then shepherd, we talk a lot this month about shepherds, but shepherd is this idea of there's one shepherd and a flock of sheep. The shepherd's at a whole different level than the flock of sheep, right? The responsibility, the intelligence, the know-how, what's going on, right? There's a very big difference between the shepherd and the sheep. And when we're walking around, who's in charge of your life? Who's going to make sure everything works out? It's Jesus, right? If you're close to the shepherd as a sheep, then you're in a good spot. Like, that's basically your big priority, is to be close to the shepherd and just go where he goes. If he turns left, you turn left. If he turns right, you turn right. If he just sits somewhere, then you just hang out there. If you keep your eyes on the shepherd, like, you'll be in the right spot. But a lot of us, we're so busy, we're so hurried, and we feel so much pressure because we're trying to control. We have a hard time with that. Right? But Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. And he could describe himself in so many ways, right? Next week, we're going to talk about his power. But the first thing Jesus describes to us is, I'm the good shepherd, and he's going to talk to us about his love. He says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Sometimes when we're facing a change in our life, we think, oh, I can't give this up, or I don't want to give this up. We haven't probably paid attention to what Jesus has given up to be with us. Jesus is never asking you to give up more than he's given for you. There's a lot of people that say they're going to be there for us, but when we really need them, they're not all that we need them to be, right? And I've failed people like that, right? Jesus here says there's no distance that he won't go. There's no amount of personal hurt that he won't go through to get to you. He knew all the stuff you're going to do, right? And he still said, like, I'm going to lay my life down for you. Because we've all had a lot of run-ins with this next character that's here. The hired hand. You know, this guy's like, hey, can you just watch my sheep for $20 or something? The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep, right? If we really pay attention to this, it might make us bristle with that pride again, right? Jesus just flippantly mentions the fact that, like, I own you. If you're a Christian, like, you belong to me. That's what this deal is. The hired hand is not, we normally think of ownership as, like, it's going to be so terrible. Jesus brings it up to show, like, because I own you, I'm going to not abandon you when something gets hard. Because we've all had that. Verse 12, the hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand, listen to this, and cares nothing for the sheep. There's a lot of people in your life who are going to tell you what you need to change or what you need to do, or you should follow me and you can start making thousands of dollars from home or whatever. I mean, right? Jesus is the only one who's going to stick with you at the level that this describes, right? He's never going to leave you. He's never going to forsake you, no matter how tough things get. So the final thing we want to do today to respond, and we've not done this sort of thing before, but I need your guys' help on it, is I believe what that says right there, that Jesus is the good shepherd. And I believe there's a bunch of us in this room who we've been reaching out to Jesus for help. We've been trying to stick close to Jesus. And so I know when you put those two things together, there's a lot of stories about how Jesus has been good, right? Somebody was talking to me this week about an interview they got. Somebody else was talking to me this week about an amazing thing that happened with their brother. I mean, there's all sorts of different stuff, right? And you might be going through something really hard. But I bet in this room there's tons of stories about here's what Jesus has done that's good to me. And so I'm going to rein us in just a couple minutes. But what I want us to do, listen to me before we do it, is I want you to get up, and we're going to go to this next slide about, like, what is Jesus? It's red and white and black. It's like the last slide, I think. No, we're frozen up. Okay, I can tell it to you. So share a way that Jesus has been good to you. And there's a bonus if it's from the last week. What's the bonus? It's just that it makes me happy. I don't have a gift. I'm sorry. But here's what I want us to do. We're going to all stand up. I want you to try to talk to somebody you don't know super well, right? So, like, Jesse and Joseph and Jesse, like, they all know each other, right? But they could talk to the people right in front of them, and they probably don't know them, right? So we're going to stand up. We're going to talk to each other. I will rein us in, and we will pray us out here in just a minute. But here's what I want you to share. Share with somebody a way Jesus has been good to you. And if you don't have something to share, just ask them and listen. That's okay too, right? So everybody stand up, talk to somebody hopefully you don't know, share a way Jesus has been good to you. Okay, thank you guys. So I'm going to pray us out, but you can keep talking after we go. This is a great conversation, right? Let's pray. Jesus, thank you that we have stories to tell because you're so good. Thank you for loving us. Jesus, help us to keep telling these stories. And I think the rest is going to work out. Help us to keep our eyes on you, Jesus. And we trust you to guide us to the right place, to take care of us, and to tell us what to do. Thank you for setting so many of us free. Please set all of Independence free. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.